Thank you, Dr. Eveling, for that very warm introduction. It's, in fact, this September it will be exactly 50 years since that first seminar that I attended at New York University, which did indeed change my whole professional life. As Richard has indicated, my two lectures are on the history, an overview of the history of the Austrian school. Let me give you an idea how I will be dividing these the material between these two lectures. I will be surveying the history of purely subjectivist explanation in economics. And that, in a way, corresponds to the history of the Austrian school. So by telling you that I'm giving you a survey of the Austrian school, I'm telling at the same time that that survey will be a survey of the history of subjectivist explanation. I'm referring back to a statement by Hayek, often repeated statement by Hayek that he published in 1952, was first published, I believe, in 1941, where he said that every advance, every significant advance in economic theory for the past 150 years, he said, has been a deepening of the subjectivist understanding. That's a very profound and insightful statement that Hayek made back in the mid-century. Every advance in economics, every advance in economic understanding represents a deepening of subjectivist understanding. And that's something that needs to be explained. The classical economic view, the view of economics back in the late 18th century and early 19th century, was that if you want to understand what happens in the economy, you have to understand the way in which physical reality constrains behavior and constrains market values and constrains the course of actions that are taken, so that everything is seen as being determined by physical reality. And you can understand that in a way. It makes sense that a country which has a rich natural resource background is going to be producing standards of living that we would all recognize to be higher than those produced in a South Sea island, which is just a rock in the middle of nowhere. So it sort of makes sense to say, yes, economic reality is a simple resultant of physical reality. That was the Ricardian, if you will, the Ricardian Marxist classical view, which many great thinkers at that time understood to be the source of explanation. Around the end of the 19th century, the Marshallian view, the view that was articulated by Alfred Marshall, the great Cambridge economist in Great Britain, he explained that the course of economic activity is the result of an interplay between physical reality and subjective preferences. So you've got, on the one hand, physical reality, the degree of productivity of resources. On the other hand, you've got the particular preferences of human beings, and these interact. In Marshall's view, supply and demand are the two blades of the scissors, where one blade is objective and one blade is subjective. The supply side is objective. The supply of goods depends on the supply of resources, and that's simply there. The nature has given you fertile land, or nature has not given you fertile land. Nature has given you labor resources, or nature has given you less labor resources. That's on the supply side. That's physical. On the demand side, Marshall said, you've got utility. You've got the preferences of human beings, the tastes of human beings, the ranking of priorities which human beings have adopted. And it's the interplay between the objective and the subjective that, for Marshall, gives us the uniquely economic explanation. Menger, Karl Menger, who was the founder of the Austrian school, back in 1871, let me tell you, when Dr. Ebeling reminded you of my first meeting with Mises 50 years ago, 1871 seemed a lot closer then than it does now. But then it seemed a long way back. It seems much further back now. 1871 was when Karl Menger published his Grundsätze, much later translated as Principles of Economics. And in that book, Menger glimpsed the possibility of understanding economic behavior and economic phenomena as being explained entirely by human preferences, by human action, by human decisions, by human activity, against the background of given resources, against the background of a given physical reality. So the active explanation for Menger was purely subjective, purely from the side of human beings. Now, we'll try and explore this, elaborate on this perhaps more during these two lectures, and I'm sure the rest of the week you'll be hearing a great deal more about it. My thesis today is that the development of this Austrian tradition has occurred in two stages. The first stage, which is going to be the topic of this first lecture, was the stage from 1871 till about the 1930s. 1871 till the 1930s. I'm saying 1930s deliberately, vaguely. During the 1930s, the first stage reached its completion. This stage consisted of, one, a glimpse by Menger. Okay, what I mentioned before was just a glimpse. He saw the possibility of explaining everything as being the result of human beings acting on human nature, on physical nature. And second, this stage consisted of a development of Menger's views, which, into my thinking, somewhat unfortunately, restricted it to what I will call static subjectivism. Okay? Static subjectivism. I'll have to explain what I mean by static subjectivism. It's a limited degree of subjectivism which was developed by Menger's colleagues and disciples. All of this, covering the period 1871 to the 1930s, represented the first stage, and I'll be talking about that in this first lecture. And then there will be, in my second lecture, I will take up the story of the Austrian tradition subsequent to the 1930s, from the mid-30s on, from the 1930s till we are today. And the major figures here will be Mises and Hayek, about whom you've heard something already and about whom you'll be hearing a great deal more this week. I will argue in my second lecture that in the mid to late 1940s, Mises and Hayek made dramatic advances in Austrian understanding. What is dramatic about it is the fact that by the 1940s, the standard view was that Austrian economics was virtually dead. The Austrian tradition was considered to have come to a complete halt by the late 1930s. I can assure you that when I studied under Mises in the early 1950s, it was an embarrassment to admit that one was studying under Mises. People would look at me with a little bit oddly, oh yeah, you're working under Mises? Because it was understood at that time that the Austrian school was dead, and that Hayek and Mises and Hayek were the post-mortem twitches of a dead body of intellectual activity. In other words, the idea was that by the late 1930s, the Austrian tradition was finished. And if you look in the history of economic thought textbooks of the early 1950s, the ones that I was studying, you will find there would be a chapter on the Austrian tradition, beginning with 1871, going on to Böhm Bawerk and Wieser, and mentioning that in the footnotes that Mises and Hayek were still alive. That was about it. So the drama was that precisely at that time, in the late 1940s, both Mises and Hayek were publishing books that, in my thinking, constituted revolutionary, dramatic advances, deepening Austrian understanding. So that this was a new departure, which in effect changed the static subjectivism of the early Austrian tradition to what we may call dynamic subjectivism. Okay, now this will be the subject of my second talk. I've given you this preview to give you an idea of how what I say in this first lecture will fit in with what I say in the second lecture. We're going to be focusing now on this first half, the period from 1871 to the 1930s, culminating in this static subjectivism of the Vienna school in the 20s and early 30s. Subsequently, we'll come back in the second lecture, hopefully, to talk about Mises and Hayek and what they did to advance Austrian economics, with, of course, the result that after the 1970s, there has been a remarkable resurgence of interest in the Austrian tradition. Okay, so that'll be the topic for the second lecture this morning. Coming back to our main topic for this morning, the period from 1871 to the mid-1930s. Some of the names have been mentioned already. Mentioned Karl Menger, just to give you some ideas of the dates. He was born in 1840, and he died in 1921. However, he retired from University of Vienna in 1903. Okay, his book, as I mentioned, was 1871, the Grundsätze der Volkswirtschaftslehre, Principles of Economics. He was alone. At that time, there was no Austrian school. He was subsequently joined by two younger colleagues. They were never students of his, Eugene von Böhm-Bawerk, his dates were 1851, so he wasn't that much younger than Menger, and he died in 1914, just about the outbreak of World War I. He was a great economist in his own right. He published major books beginning 1881, 1884, and then 1889. These were two volumes that together made up his theory of capital. He became finance minister in the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, and his before the euro, his picture was on the banknotes, Austrian banknotes. So he was an enduring famous figure in Austria, but he, for us, he was important as a one of the pioneers who picked up the subjectivist ideas of Karl Menger and developed them into a great system. He returned to full-time academic life in the early 1900s, maybe 1904 perhaps, 1905, and he led a famous seminar up until World War I. He led a famous seminar in which you had a really star-studded group of young scholars in that seminar. Besides Mises, there was Schumpeter, there was Otto Bauer, Marxist. There were Bukharin, the Marxist scholar killed by Stalin. These were all members of Brombaverk's seminar in the University of Vienna. A third figure, also a younger colleague of Menger, was Friedrich von Wiese. He was also born in 1851 and he died in 1926. He was a brother-in-law of Brombaverk, not important, but he happened to be a brother-in-law of Eugene von Brombaverk, and they studied together and they were both fascinated by Menger's 1871 book. Menger himself, by the way, became, soon after he wrote his book, he became the tutor to the Crown Prince of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. Subsequently, he became the professor at University of Vienna. By the end of the 1880s, that is almost two decades after the publication of his book, he had developed a whole school. There was already a well-recognized group of scholars who wrote their dissertations under Menger. There was a stream of books being published coming out of University of Vienna, and the British and Americans were getting interested in this, and translations began to appear at around that time. Translations of particularly of Brombaverk's books, Wiese's books, became translated. There was a Scottish economist, William Smart, who was engaged in translations. Both Brombaverk and Wiese were invited to write survey papers in American and British journals describing what was going on in Vienna at that time. So this was a flourishing young school by about 1890. They were considered to be the enemies, the intellectual enemies of what is known as the German historical school. The German historical school, led by Gustav Schmaller. The German historical school and the Austrians were considered to be mortal enemies. Mortal. I think if they would have met each other, they would have stabbed each other. Probably. This was not a very polite disagreement. It's sometimes called the Methodenstreit, the war on method. It's rather interesting that when Menger published his book in 1871, he dedicated it to Wilhelm Rascher, R-S-C-H-E-R, who was one of the great German historical school economists, one of the older German school economists of the mid 19th century, to whom Menger was paying deep respect, and he was hoping that Menger, together with the German historical school, would get together to develop a integrated view that would finally overthrow the classical school. However, the younger German historical school, particularly Schmaller and some of his colleagues, were bitterly critical of Menger's book, and this turned Menger around so that he realized that he did not have any potential allies among the German historical economists. And he wrote in 1883, he wrote another book in which he sharply criticized the method of the German historical school. Because while they were criticizing the classical school, and you might think that the enemy of your enemy is your friend, it turned out that the point of view from which they were criticizing the classical school was a totally different one. They were criticizing not merely the objective physical character of the theorizing of the classical school, they were criticizing the concept of economic theory altogether. They were basically saying that economics must be a study of empirical developments, detailed historical study, not a conceptual theoretical set of principles altogether. Now, as I say, this is the background. The background of the development of the Austrian school has to be understood that they were the bitter enemies, the methodological enemies of the German historical school. And while today it might seem as if, you had the Germans, you had the Austrians, and the stature, the intellectual stature of the University of Vienna might seem to be pretty great, pretty good. At that time, it wasn't seen that way. Vienna was seen as a backwater, intellectual backwater. The great scientific advances were in the German universities, so that the Germans looked down on the Austrians as being newcomers, as being almost country bumpkins in a way from an intellectual point of view. So they looked down on them and they criticized them. In fact, the term Austrian school was first given by the German historical economists as a term of opprobrium. Oh, the Austrian school. It was a put down. They're the Austrians. The Austrians, of course, later on took this as a title to be proud of. But it wasn't originally seen that way. Originally, the term was a term of derogation. By the end of World War One, Menge had already died. Okay, died in 1921. I say already. The World War One ended in 1918, but he died in 1921. He had retired, as I mentioned, in 1903. He was busy trying to get a second edition, working on a second edition of his book. He never published it. His son published it. Karl Menger Jr., a great mathematician, published a second edition. But it never had the revolutionary impact of the first edition of the 1871 Grundsätze. So by the end of World War One, say by 1921, Menge had died. Bombeck had died back in 1914. Wiese was still alive till 1926. But the scene was of course quite different. The scene was a different scene. And in the 20s, the Austrian school was a very vigorous school, very vigorous, very very much alive. Was very successful from a professional point of view. If you were, let's say, an American visiting Europe, say you were a graduate student visiting Europe, or a young professor visiting Europe, you'd make a point of going to Vienna. You'd try and sit in on a seminar in Vienna. In Vienna, at that time, during the 1920s, you had basically two major figures. One was Mises, and one was Hans Meyer. Hans Meyer was a student of Wiese, protege of Wiese, and he took over Wiese's chair. Wiese was occupying Karl Menger's chair, right? You had Karl Menger retired in 1983. Wiese was at different universities, but towards the end of his life, he was occupying Menger's chair at the University of Vienna. When he died, his protege Hans Meyer took over his professorship, and there was a circle seminar around Hans Meyer. Okay, Mises was also at the University of Vienna, not as a full-time professor, as you might say. He never received a full professorship at the University of Vienna. In fact, his major activity was with something which is translated as the Chamber of Commerce. It was a quasi-governmental agency in which Mises found himself engaged in very important policy discussions and policy recommendations. He was engaged not simply in academics. He was a very practical, hands-on economist in some of the major issues of the time. And if you'll read Mises' biography, autobiography, his notes and recollections, you'll find it fascinating how he describes some of the struggles and some of the challenges and some of the battles that he fought during the 1920s as in his position as the economist for the Chamber of Commerce. He was involved in all of the major issues of economic issues of the time. Between Mises and Hans Meyer, there was no love lost. They were at odds with each other as well for personal and other reasons. But there was a circle around Hans Meyer, and there was a circle around Mises. The circle around Mises was sometimes called a Privatseminar, his private seminar. That is, besides the seminar that he had in the university. He had every 2 weeks in his office at the Chamber of Commerce, there would gather together a group of young scholars that really turned out to be a remarkable group. Just to mention some of the names, Hayek was a member of that seminar. Oscar Morgenstern, who of course later on was involved in the development of a theory of games, game theory. Fritz Machlup, who was one of the great economists in the United States in the second half of the 20th century. Gottfried Haberler, eminent Harvard economist. All of these were members of Mises' seminar. Paul Rosenstein Radin was a member of that seminar, although he was also connected with Hans Meyer's circle. So there was a great deal of activity in Vienna. I'll mention one non-Austrian name to illustrate the importance of the Vienna school, the Austrian tradition at that time, and that's the name of Lionel Robbins. Lionel Robbins, who later on became Lord Robbins, Lionel Robbins was a brilliant young economist at London School of Economics. And he made a number of trips to Vienna, and he became deeply influenced by all of the Austrian economists of the 1920s. In 1932, Robbins published a very important book, The Nature and Significance of Economic Science, which is one of the pivotal books in 20th century economics. It's not read that much today, but if you'll look back and think back over the history of 20th century economics, you will recognize that book was pivotal in developing modern neoclassical microeconomic theory. And that was written primarily under the influence of the Austrians. I will say that it was written under the influence of what I've called static subjectivism. And that's the reason why, I would argue, that's the reason why the Austrian influence on 20th century economics has primarily been at the stage of static subjectivism, which I'll come to explain and develop, hopefully, a bit more carefully. So, you might say then in 1932, when Robbins published his book, you might say Austrian economics was riding high. The Austrian tradition was at its greatest point. And yet, I said that by the end of the 1930s, Austrian economics was considered to be dead. We had a colleague at New York University who studied under Hayek in the 1930s. His name was Ludwig Lachmann. His name will become familiar to you, I think, by the end of the week. Ludwig Lachmann was a subjectivist, a radical subjectivist, a dynamic subjectivist, far beyond static subjectivism. And he explains, he came to London from Berlin in about 1933, and he became a student of Hayek's at that time. And he has stated that when he came to London in 1933, everybody was a Hayekian. Because Hayek came to London, I neglected to mention that, Hayek came to London in 1931 as a visiting lecturer. He gave a series of lectures that were published, a brilliant series of lectures were published as Prices and Production in 1931, and then he was subsequently, in 1932, given a very prestigious chair at the University of London. So by 1933, everybody was a Hayekian. The Austrian ideas were the Austrian business cycle theory, which was what Hayek was primarily presenting, that became extremely popular in British economic circles. Everybody was a Hayekian. That was in 1933. By 1938, Lachman reports, there were only two Hayekians left. Hayek and Lachman. And that shows the precipitous decline of Austrian economics in Great Britain during the 1930s. So that demands explanation. So what I've given you so far is a very rapid survey of some of the personalities and names and dates and books of the period. But I'd like now to get to some of the content of the Austrian tradition and what I mean by static subjectivism, and what I meant by saying that there was a glimpse by Menger of something going beyond static subjectivism. See, I'll be arguing in my second lecture that what Mises and Hayek were doing was to develop that glimpse in the direction that Menger had not developed it himself, and which his followers, his colleagues and younger followers, had not picked up on. They had not developed it as Hayek and as Mises and Hayek were to do in the late 1940s. So let me try and give you a very brief bird's eye view of what I see as Menger's, as a glimpse by Menger. Think of the economic process in the following terms. You start out with natural resources. Natural resources refer to, of course, physical resources, land, water resources, and labor. Labor resources are part of natural resources. You've got a population with the ability to provide labor services. So you've got natural resources. At the end of the economic process is consumer goods. After all, that's the point of an economic system, is to produce consumer goods that will provide a standard of living to consumers. That's what they want. They want to eat. They want to wear clothing. They want to be entertained. They want to enjoy intellectual activity. All of those require consumer goods. They require food. They require clothing. They require automobiles. They require classrooms. They require books. They require movies. They require all kinds of things. Okay, so that's the beginning and that's the end, right? The economic process then is a physical process which starts with natural resources and goes down through a whole series of stages, a whole series of productive stages, from natural resources to consumer goods. Now, if you look at this from a positive, descriptive perspective, you will say, well, this is the direction, this is the chronological direction, okay? You start with natural resources, your land becomes wheat, your wheat becomes flour, your flour becomes bread, okay? Your bread becomes a sandwich, okay? And finally, the sandwich is consumed by the consumer, okay? Along the road, there's been a lot of other things happening. Somebody had to chop down the trees to permit the land to become arable land. Somebody had to plow the land. Somebody had to make the plows with which to plow the land. Somebody had to build the mills with which to grind the grain. Somebody had to build the tractors with which to cut the grain. Okay, somebody had to build the ovens which are going to bake the bread. Somebody has to make the sandwiches. Okay, all of that is happening But it's all determined by what you start out with. You start out with physical goods, and you finish up with consumer goods and services, of course, and services. So when you look at it from a positive point of view, the causation, right? Causation. This is a philosophically suspect word, causality, causation. I recently saw the presidential address to the History of Economic Society, in which he talked about lost causes, meaning that the notion of causation became lost. Okay, but in a everyday sense, and certainly in a layperson's sense, causation is something we all understand and appreciate, and that's what we're trying to get. So what causes the economic activity? Well, the causation is a physical causation. You start out here, and that generates results. So that's the cause, and those are the results. And that's how the classical economists looked at it. In fact, when you get down to the nitty-gritty of classical economic theory, value theory, you'll find a cost theory of value, right? Sometimes a labor theory of value, which says that the value of consumer goods is determined by the value, by the amounts of resources that go into them. So that the reason why a chair is less valuable than a jumbo jet, why is a chair less valuable than a jumbo jet? Everybody agrees it's less valuable. Why is it less valuable? Well, the classical economist would say it's obvious. Look at all the resources that go into that are needed to produce the jumbo jet. Look at the small amount of resources required to produce a chair. So obviously the jumbo jet is more valuable, more important, more significant from an economic point of view than the chair. Menger saw things differently. He saw things quite differently. Let me illustrate the way in which he saw value particularly. This is a treasure box. Okay? It contains $1 billion in gold. I used to say a million. That was probably 50 years ago. $1 billion in gold, right? $1 billion in gold. And it's yours. It's yours. Unfortunately, you've lost the key. It's a very strong box. They built that box to keep $1 billion. It's a very strong box. The only way you could get that open would be to explode it, in which case your gold would be sent off to interstellar space. So there's a keyhole here, and you've lost the key. So you don't have $1 billion. Somebody found that key. He's an honest person. He's not gonna steal your $1 billion. Never think of doing that. But listen, he found the key, fair and square. Are you willing to buy it from him? Of course you are. You offer him $100 for the key. He said, for $1 billion, that's all you give me, $100? All right, I'll give you $1,000. Listen, I mean, if you subtract $1,000 from $1 billion, you still got quite a bit of change. But the guy who found the key, he's not having any of that. That key is worth more to you than $1,000. In fact, think about it. How much would you be willing to pay for that key? If you couldn't get the key for less than $500 million, wouldn't you pay $500 million? After all, $500 million is going to be left. Let me push you a bit further. Supposing he insisted on a price of $999,000. Well, you still have $1 million left. Wouldn't it be worthwhile to you to do it? If that's the only way, what's the alternative? The alternative is zero. Which is better, $1 million or zero? Clearly, $1 million. If you'll follow that logic to the bitter end, what are you going to be willing to pay for that key? $1 billion minus? Well, a dime. 50 cents, a dollar, whatever, right? You'd be willing to pay almost $1 billion because the value of the key is $1 billion. The key has the value of $1 billion. Why? Why? Why does the key have the value of $1 billion? Because the key is the key to $1 billion. What gives you the key, the value of $1 billion? The end gives the means. You've got ends and you've got means. The key is the end, right? Excuse me, the $1 billion is the end and the key is the means. What is the value of the key? The value of the key is determined by the value of the ends. Get it? So that the value is determined not resource value determining product value, determining consumer goods value, just the other way around. Is consumer goods the value, the importance of consumer goods to the consumer, which determines the value of resources? How much are you willing to pay for a natural resource? How much are you willing to pay for that field from which you can grow bread to make sandwiches? It depends on how much you want the sandwich. If you want the sandwich very urgently, the value of the land will go up. If you're not interested in sandwiches, then who needs the land? So that the causation is this way, diametrically opposed to the classical view. 180 degrees different. That's not a mid-course correction. That's not an adjustment, a massaging of a classical view. That's turning things around. Turning things 180 degrees round. It's not the value of means that determines the value of ends. It's the value of ends that determines the value of means. That was a Mengerian perception. And that was a revolutionary in 1871. In effect, this was the glimpse that Menger had. In effect, he was saying, you want to understand everything that goes on between here and there? You know, we talk about natural resources and consumer goods. There's a lot going on in between. If you'll take a trip into Manhattan or take a trip anywhere in the United States, you'll see a lot of economic activity somewhere in between. Somewhere in between, you see a truck driving on a highway. That truck is delivering something. Maybe consumer goods, maybe parts to some machine that's necessary at some stage. There's an intricate economic process, production process going on in many different areas, many different industries, many different competing walks of life. You're going to an engineering school. That's part of this process. You're training. You're taking raw labor and translating it into skilled engineering labor. Skilled engineering talent. You've got an enormous volume of economic activity between the original resources you get from nature and the final flows of consumer goods that come rolling off your assembly lines. And what the glimpse that Menger had was that everything in here, all the values in here, not just the values, but all of the particular activities, the choices of activities, the choices of specialization that will be chosen, the choices of which engineering school to go to, whether to go to engineering school or medical school or law school or whatever, all of those choices are determined ultimately by what? By what consumers want. If consumers want heart surgery, people will go to medical school. If people want bridges, people go to engineering school. It depends what people want here. That will determine against the background. Granted, the background's important, but it's background. The active chains of cause and effect are generated by consumers, are generated by human beings. Remember, the producers are human beings too. The people who produce bridges, the people who produce automobiles, the people who teach medical students, they're human beings too. Why are they teaching medical students? Why are they producing automobiles? Why are they producing bridges? Because they're consumers too. It's because they are consumers that they are teaching medical students. Because they are consumers that they are teaching, that they are building bridges. It's because they are consumers that they are making the steel that will help produce the bridges. So it's the human beings who are the consumers who are determining everything in this system. So everything is going to start from here. This is the beginning. And all the way, everything, ripples of causation go all the way up. Now that's a subjectivist explanation. Okay, it was glimpsed by Menger. The colleagues, the younger colleagues, the ones that I mentioned before, particularly Bombavik and Wieser, developed some of the fundamental insights, but they missed, I believe, the dramatic overall perspective, the dramatic change in direction. They recognized, not just they recognized, they developed, they amplified the subjectivist theory of value, which Menger had initiated in 1871, an explanation which says that the value of commodities is determined not by cost of production, but by utility, but the degree to which consumers want particular commodities. So that the relative value of cheese versus fish versus meat versus poultry versus some other food is determined by the values which people place on these different alternative foods, different alternative consumer goods. They developed that. But they developed it in what I will call a static way, static subjectivist way. Static subjectivism is often defined in terms of what it misses out, what it leaves out. It leaves out creativity. And it leaves out indeterminacy. The indeterminacy of the future. Let me just briefly explain what I mean by this. Bombavik, Wieser, and the Austrian economists of the 1920s, they emphasized that values are determined by consumers. But they saw consumer preferences as something that was there. Some consumers want meat, some consumers want fish, some consumers want eggs, some consumers want milk, dairy products, okay? These are different preferences. Some like red cars, some like green cars, some like red hats, some like blue hats, some like cotton, some like wool. These are preferences. Those preferences are there. Those preferences determine the direction of production. They determine what's going to be produced. They determine the values placed by markets on particular elements in this system. So that the value of red dye will be determined by the degree to which consumers want red sweaters and things like that. Okay, they understood that, but they saw preferences as something which was given. It's data, which means that they are leaving out the possibility of consumer creativity and of entrepreneurial creativity, where the consumer comes up with something that didn't exist before. He has a new idea, a new desire that he didn't have before. It also abstracts from the indeterminacy of the future. It treats the future as something that can be predicted with certainty. It abstracts from the fact that what the consumer does is to face an uncertain future where he's not sure what the choices are. If you've studied standard neoclassical microeconomics, you will recognize that the unit of analysis is the act of choice, the decision. But the decision is seen in modern microeconomics, non-Austrian microeconomics, as being the choices made between given alternatives, where the terms of exchange are given. And I sometimes put it this way. Supposing this is the decision-making room, then in terms of standard microeconomics, you'd knock on the door, I want to make a decision. Yeah, you want to make a decision? Fine. Just leave us your preference patterns. Leave us your resource constraint lists. Go back, go someplace, have a cup of coffee, come back in 15 minutes, and we'll tell you what you've decided. Hold that again. You're going to tell me what I've decided? Well, yes. If you've told me what your preferences are, and you've told me what your resource constraints are, you've asked me to maximize your satisfaction subject to given constraints. Well, that's a mathematical problem. That's what we're here for. Give us the data. Go back and come back in 15 minutes and we'll tell you what you've decided. But who decided? Well, you decided because it's your preferences. Subjectivism, right? Well, that sounds a little bit odd. And it is odd. But that's what static subjectivism means. It's odd. But it's subjectivism. It's your preferences. It's your perception of the resources. But the decision has no creativity in it. No indeterminacy in it. If you're deciding whether you should get married or not, would you knock on the door? Here's my data. Please decide. Tell me what I've decided, whether to get married or not. You wouldn't look at it that way. You agonize. You'll be agonizing all night. If you're deciding whether you should go to law school or medical school, what you're deciding about is not what the mathematical maximization point is. Given your resources and given your preferences, you're trying to predict whether people in 20, 30 years' time are going to be having heart attacks or going to be engaged in litigation. You're trying to anticipate an uncertain, indeterminate future. That's what decision-making is. That's left out in what we've called static subjectivism. Okay? No place for that. No place for creativity. No place for recognizing the indeterminacy of the future, the unknowability of the future. I can illustrate what I mean by the static subjectivism of Austrian economics in the 1920s and early 1930s by turning to Fritz Machlop. Fritz Machlop, who towards the end of his life was a colleague of mine at New York University. I'm sure, right. He was one of the great 20th century economists. He grew up in Vienna. He believed, A, that he was enormously proud of having been trained in Vienna in the 1920s. But he believed also that everything that was important in the Austrian tradition of the 1920s had been successfully absorbed into the mainstream. And he was right. The Austrian economics of the 1920s had been absorbed into the mainstream. So that Machlop, in his mature career, did not find it necessary to identify himself as an Austrian. Because we're all Austrians now, so to speak. The Austrian tradition had become successfully absorbed. Robin's book of 1932 meant that the Austrian economics was taking over the Anglo-American school. That's how Machlop himself would have seen it. Towards the end of his life, he was asked on a number of occasions to list the tenets of the Austrian tradition. And he listed six items. I haven't been allocating my time very, very successfully, very efficiently. So I'm going to just read them off. Methodological individualism. And I'm going to sort of put some interjections here. Methodological individualism, what does that mean? That's micro. Everybody understands there's a room for micro. You don't have to be an Austrian to appreciate methodological individualism. Methodological subjectivism? Well, everybody has room for demand theory. Everybody has room for marginal utility theory. Everybody has room for consumer preferences. Marginalism, that's number three. Marginalism? Everybody's a marginalist. Opportunity cost? Well, that's the professional jargon. What does an economist talk about? What's the difference between an economist and a non-economist? Economists understand about opportunity costs. Nobody else does. The time structure of production, that was a something that Austrians emphasized, which non-Austrians had not emphasized early on, by the mid-century, I think you'll have to agree that non-Austrians are fully aware of the time structure of production as well. None of these are unique to Austrian economics. I will argue in my second lecture that Machlab, when he drew a line here, he was ignoring two very important features of Austrian economics which he had not been taught in the 1920s. So he was giving a faithful rendition of what Austrian economics meant in the 1920s when he was trained in Vienna. But he was not aware, he did not fully understand, that there were two additional features of Austrian economics which we will take up in the second lecture, and I'll list them here, and we'll have to develop them in the second lecture. The first is that markets are processes of learning and discovery. You may remember that Dr. Ebeling indicated that was the first statement I heard from Mises, that markets are processes. The market is a process. This is the point. Processes of learning. The market is a process of learning. That's the one additional feature of Austrian economics which Machlab was not aware of. And the second is that choice is undertaken in the context of radical uncertainty. Unlike Robbins, in his book, he emphasized that economizing activity takes place against the background of given ends and means. Given ends, given means. No room for creativity. No room for indeterminacy. Everything is given. Your options are given. There's a plate. You can have this goody or that goody. You can't have both. You can take one. Which goody is the best for you? Well, that's, I like that, but it requires me to look a little bit greedy for reading over that. So, all right, you take that into account. Right? But everything is given right in front of you. Choice from a modern Austrian perspective, from a post-1940 or 1950 perspective, recognizes that choice is creative, that choice is in the face of an indeterminate, unknown, and unknowable future. Makes a big difference. Makes a big difference how you see choice. Okay, those are two features of modern Austrian economics. I say modern meaning post-1950 economics, the economics that we're going to attribute to Mises and Hayek in the second lecture. Okay, that was absent in the static subjectivism of the tradition as it developed up until the 1930s. And as we shall see, it was Mises and Hayek in their dramatic books of the late 1940s that made these revolutionary advances in Austrian understanding. Okay, I think we'll stop here, and I'm sure you have some questions. Yes, sir. Okay. I think I skipped one. I skipped one. Okay. I went over the methodological individualism. I can elaborate on that if you wish. Methodological subjectivism, marginalism, opportunity cost, time structure of production. The one that I missed was the dominance of utility. What Machlab meant by the dominance of utility is as follows. You may remember that when I talked about Marshall early in the lecture, I said that Marshall saw supply and demand as two blades of a scissors. He used that analogy, the scissors analogy. When you cut paper with a pair of scissors, which blade does the cutting? The answer is that's the wrong way to look at it. The cutting occurs because of the interplay of both blades. Both blades together cut the paper. So which is it, supply or demand? Well, Marshall said that's a mistake. It's the interplay of supply and demand. Okay. The Austrians, in Machlab's understanding, said that's true. There are supply conditions and there are demand conditions. But supply is subjective too, meaning the supply of any commodity is the implied demand for other commodities, which that resource might have been used to produce. So if labor is used to produce a bridge, right? Labor producing a bridge. What is the cost of the bridge in terms of labor? The answer is, it depends. You'd have to pay, the bridge manufacturers would have to pay the labor an amount which will withdraw that labor from producing chairs. Okay? So it's the value of the chairs to consumers which is going to determine the value of the labor which has to be paid by the bridge manufacturers. So it's utility again. It's all utility. Both blades are utility. You've got cost, right? But costs are opportunity costs. So when I mention opportunity costs, in a way that covers this. Opportunity cost is another way of explaining the dominance of utility. That was I should have recognized that was a uniquely Austrian perspective, and the Austrians did emphasize that they believed that the Marshallians were wrong in thinking that supply has to be understood as expressing as purely physical conditions. They saw supply as being a mirror of demand conditions in alternative industries. That was the Austrian view, and that is a consistent subjectivism. Okay, so that was what the sixth, and the others that I mentioned are what: opportunity cost, time structure, production. I think I've given you all six. Okay.
I just wondered, what's the relationship between Menger and Jevons? I mean, there was a simultaneous discovery of, I mean, the marginalist revolution seemed to be simultaneous around 1870.
Right. You're quite correct, of course. There were three major pioneers in marginal utility revolution. William Stanley Jevons, who also published his book in 1871, Menger, and Walras, 1874. Those were the three pioneers in the marginal utility revolution. You can look at it, very often the three pioneers are considered to have been saying the same thing, and sort of there was a well-known expert on Walrasian economics, Jaffe, who wrote a famous paper 30 or 40 years ago called the dehomogenization of the three marginal utility pioneers, in which he demonstrated that these were not saying the same thing. There were differences, important differences, between Jevons and Menger and Walras. One way of putting the difference has been expressed as follows. For Jevons and for Walras, the important was the adjective. And for Menger, the importance was the noun. Marginal utility has an adjective, marginal, and a noun, utility. For Jevons and for Walras, the important insight was marginalism, the marginal, it's the adjective. For Menger, the important element in marginal utility theory was the utility idea. That would sort of put it in a nutshell, perhaps. Of course, the common feature among all of them, they were marginalists. You see, the old problem had been Adam Smith's problem, was how can you tell me that utility determines value? Everybody knows that water gives more utility than diamonds. Water, life depends on water. Life is more important than diamonds. So if it's utility, you'd expect water to have a higher value per bucket than diamonds. And yet we know that a bucket of diamonds has a greater market value than a bucket of water. And the solution to that, which all of the marginal utility theorists recognized, was that you've got to recognize, subjectively, you've got to recognize that one bucket of water is not the same as the second bucket of water. The first bucket of water that you get in the Sahara Desert is very, very important. Your life depends on it. But the bucket of water you get at the faucet here in Irvington, that's not important. Your life doesn't depend on it at all, because you've got so many other buckets of water anywhere you want. So it's diminishing marginal utility, okay? But that's a subjectivist insight, that the value of a commodity depends on the margin at which it is being evaluated. What is the choice? Where is the choice? Is it the choice between the first bucket of water and your diamond necklace? Is that the choice? Then the bucket of water ranks higher than the than the diamond necklace. But if it's the 15th bucket of water, and certainly if it's the 1500th bucket of water, then your diamond necklace is more value, because it's your first diamond necklace, your only diamond necklace that you have. So that's more important than the 1500th bucket of water. See, that was a marginal insight, which they all had, which they all shared. And it was the marginalism that represented the revolutionary idea for Jevons and for these and for, excuse me, for Walras. But as we've indicated, it's the utility idea that was the fundamental insight of Mango. Okay.
Can I just ask one more question?
Sure.
What was so magical about the year 1870? Why did all these insights happen at that time and not 20 years later or 20 years before?
I don't have the answer to that question. There have been attempts to explain it. When I first started studying economics, two years before I met Mises, I was told by my very first economics teacher, I was told, you know why the marginal utility theorists came up in 1871? Because in 1867 there was a book that was published entitled Das Kapital. So these were the bourgeois economists who had to come up with a new theory in order to cope with the Marxist insights. Now, I don't believe that's true. That's what I was taught. I was taught that the 1871 marginal utility revolution was a reaction to Marxian doctrine. The problem with that is that Jevons published his first paper on marginal utility in 1862, right? His book was in 1871, but he had presented a paper in 1862. So I don't buy that particular explanation, but I don't have an alternative one. Marxists would react to that. Sure, he published it in 1862, but nobody paid any attention. Why was there so much attention paid to the 1871 book? Ah, that's where it is. So I don't have a conspiratorial theory of the history of economic thought. I remember Mark Blaug, in his really brilliant economic theory in retrospect, he has a discussion of what are the causal factors in changing economic doctrines. He considers this possibility, the ideological one, which is what I was taught, as I say, as an undergraduate. I don't think he accepts that either. I certainly don't. He considers simply sort of scientific advance. He considers the possibility of causation as a result of external commercial developments, changes in pattern of industry. Might focus analytical attention on new combinations, new relationships. He focuses as the possibility of changing philosophical, cultural doctrines in the wider intellectual area. He considers a whole series of possible explanations, and he focuses particularly on the question of the remarkable coincidence of the 1870s being the time for the development of these new ideas. Yes?
This idea of radical uncertainty and the creativity of choice, I don't know if this might be a really big topic to open, but just how does that relate to kind of getting us out of a deterministic way of thinking about choice? I mean, someone could say that any one moment upon which the choice is made, the data is given. It's not given to any one person. But is it not a mathematical problem at the moment of choice that cannot be known before that moment of choice? But does that allow us to escape from determinacy?
No, I'll be talking perhaps a little bit about it in my second lecture. Let me just put one name on the board that belongs in the second lecture. That is Shackle. George Shackle was no Austrian. He was a student of Hayek in the 1930s. And he was one of the sweetest economists imaginable. Most times, economists are pretty nasty, nasty bunch. But he was the sweetest man you can imagine. He would bend over backwards to see merit in other people's writings. He was a meek, modest man. But that has nothing to do with what I'm going to say now. But I can't mention his name without drawing attention to that. Shackle's position was that choice is so creative. It's in the face of indeterminacy to such a degree that no choice is ever predictable, even in principle. In other words, it gets into theological almost questions of free will. At the time of choice, there is nothing that constrains choice. So the idea of somebody leaving his data and we telling you what you've decided, that's for Shackle, that's nonsensical. Because the moment of decision is the decision where you decide what your data are. That's part of the decision. Okay? Now, let me show you where this leads. This leads into almost embarrassing results. Therefore, Shackle says, every moment is a new beginning. Now think about that. At this moment, millions and millions of decisions are being made. Now, Shackle says you have to recognize that each of those decisions is undetermined by past history, which means each moment is a new beginning. Hold on. You really mean that? You mean that there's no sequence of history? No causal chains in history? I don't believe that. I believe there are causal chains in history. I don't believe that you are here accidentally. I think that you are here because you heard about an Austrian seminar, you heard about Phi, you heard publicity about it, and you came here. There are determinate? Well, there are systematic chains of cause and effect in history, in human history, and in economic history too. That's what I believe. But if you take Shackle literally, and you focus on this indeterminacy and creativity and take it and run with it and just shut your eyes to everything else, then you are eliminating from human history, certainly from economic chains of development, chronological economic activity, you are eliminating all causation entirely. That goes a bit too far, in my opinion. Now, I think we have to stop here because otherwise there'll be some causation as far as the beginning of the time of the second lecture. Okay, thank you very much.